So, here we go. So this is our second week in this session, which is session 3. And it's also the second week in which we are considering or going round again on the issue of space. I noticed that Kathleen has pointed out for everybody online, at least, that everybody's muted. So you should unmute yourself if you want to speak. So we're going around about space. It's very interesting how to approach this, it seems to me. It's very important, as I said. And it's also important to try to keep it from getting too abstract or too removed from our ordinary experience. So we'll try to get to that. We'll try to see, you know, how can we make that happen. So the main thing in this chapter, for this last week we read the first part of the chapter, and this week we're reading the second part. The main thing that's going on in this chapter is that Rinpoche really introduces the idea of considering the mind as being like space. So there's a sentence, one of these sentences that's in italic and in the center of the page, so we know it's important. On what is it? I don't remember the page number right now, but it says, mind, like space, has no foundation. And that's one place he makes that point. But the whole chapter is really working with mind as an instance, I would say, of space. And we want to start by exploring that. Typically, I mean, we have a lot of ways of talking about the mind that are space-like. You know, we say, I don't have, you know, my mind is full. I mean, you know, just sort of simple things like that. Or I can't get my head around that, which is a way of talking about the mind, really. Or in German, you'd say, das geht mir nicht in den Kopf rein, which is basically, you know, just, I don't get it, but it doesn't fit in my head, you know. So we have this sense of the mind as being like space, but typically we'd say, well, that's an analogy. You know, we don't know anything about the mind directly, so we wind up using analogies from things we do know, which have to do with the external world. And the language we've developed to talk about mind is therefore like the language of the external world, and talking about the mind in space-like terms is an example of that. But that's just an analogy. It doesn't really tell us anything about the mind. And that's an ordinary way of understanding it, and you can go along with that. But if you do, you're leaving out, I think, or missing something that Rinpoche is pointing to that is more fundamental than that. And the way to think about that is that the space that Rinpoche is talking about, we could say great space, but we don't even have to go that far. Just the understanding that he has of space isn't in any way limited to physical space. And that's a very important move in the TSK vision. What makes space is not confined to the physical. And there's a simple way of suggesting why that would be the case. You know, if space has no properties, why should it be limited to the physical? You know, when you say, well, space is physical and physical objects show up in space, you can say that. But you're making an assumption about the nature of space, which is really inconsistent with your basic sense that space is nothing at all. It's nothing at all, but somehow it's physical. Well, you could just try saying that. You know, that's one way of thinking about it. But there's no inherent reason to do that. And if you think back to the definition, and Rinpoche really does give a definition of space, which we saw last time. Let me see if I can find it quickly here. It's on page... maybe I can't. Yeah, here it is. It's on page 50. He says, So from now on, he says, when we talk about space, we're talking about a dimension of reality whose openness is necessary and goes along with everything that appears, everything that appears. It's not just physical space. It definitely includes all kinds of appearance, which would include mental appearance. So thoughts and feelings and emotions and memories and the kinds of things that you know show up in the mind. And when we say it that way, again, we're using a spatial metaphor. Things show up in the mind in the same way that objects appear in space. So when Rinpoche talks about space, it's this quality of openness, this quality of accommodation. That's what space is. It's not limited to the physical realm. So if we focus on that notion of accommodation, we realize that there's no reason not to talk about mind in space-like terms. And talking about it that way helps us understand something about space. And also, by the way, it helps us understand some very interesting things about mind and explore the nature of our mental experience. So because mind has no foundation, like space, to go back to that quote, it can allow everything to appear. Now, is it really true that it can allow everything? No, it can only allow mind-like things to appear. So if you just take an example and you say, well, can a tree appear in the mind? No, a tree appears in physical space. The idea of the tree, or the recognition of the tree, or the experience of seeing the tree, however you want to talk about that, that shows up in the mind. And so that, again, is a way of pointing toward this close connection, because we'd say, well, the tree is in physical space, but every possibility we have for knowing about the tree is in the mind, you know, given our usual way of talking about mind. It's all about taking hold of or encountering or experiencing, making contact with this thing that we then say must be in physical space. And if you think about that connection, first of all, you see that mental space and physical space are very closely connected. No tree in physical space, then no experience of a tree as being right in front of us. We might still imagine a tree or think of a tree or remember a tree, but no experience of the tree as being there. So the two, the mental and the physical, are closely connected. But also you could say the mental is in some ways, it doesn't matter for our purposes right now, but the mental is actually primary, because what we have is an inner experience of a tree. An inner experience, you know, shows up, and we say, that's because there's really a tree in front of us. But that's actually a theory. You know, our explanation for why we have this seeing a tree kind of experience is that there is, quote, really a tree in front of us. But that's already secondary. Mind is really primary. Experience is really primary. This is something that's so obvious in a sense that it's hard to talk about. It's also hard to talk about because it goes against our usual way of speaking and thinking about things. We say, well, I see a tree because a tree is really there. So we put the really on the external side. You know, the part that's real is the tree is really there. And then because of that, I get to see it. But in terms of our experience, it's really the other way around. We say, I really see a tree. Why is that? And then we have to kind of speculate. And we say, well, probably, most likely, most of the time when that happens, it makes sense to say that I'm seeing a tree. That the tree is actually there. But what's primary is the mental dimension. So we want to look at the mind in a kind of a space-like way. That is, we want to understand that just or we want to start, you could say, from the view that mind has this capacity to accommodate because it shares with physical space the openness, the no foundation. What that seems to lead to is that you could say, well, physical space is one aspect of space, and mental space is one aspect of space. And the more fundamental dimension of what space is shared by both of them. And again, as I said, you could talk about great space here. I don't think that's quite right, but it might help you to think about it. If you say there's two different levels of space. So there's the particular space realms, the mental realm, the physical realm, and you could add others, but for most purposes, those are the two big ones. There are those space realms, but then there's something more fundamental, which is the accommodating and allowing and open quality of space that they share, which is why we can speak of them as being space realms. So now we want to talk more about mind. Really, we're going to focus. Well, we'll come back to physical space in one respect in a moment. But mostly we're going to be talking about mind because mostly the chapter talks about mind. And the exercises 11 through 14, really are the heart of this chapter, right? They're the kind of structure through which the chapter proceeds. So we'll talk about the exercises also. So, we're talking about mind, and mind is a kind of space. And maybe the first, really important point to say about mind is that we never actually encounter mind. And in that sense, too, it's like space. You say we never really encounter space. That's only partly true. You might say you have a sense of the spaciousness of space, the openness of space, or the opposite. You might have a sense that space feels closed in and crowded and constricted. So there are spatial dimensions to our experience. And in the same way, you could say we don't ever encounter mind, but we do encounter qualities associated with mind, like clarity or confusion. Those things are parallel, the physical side and the mental side. But in both cases, there's never a thing we come across that we can call space or call mind. And that's because they're more fundamental. They have no foundation. They have no identity. So they're not thing-like. So when we talk about mind, we're usually just kind of presupposing it. Well, if thoughts show up, there has to be a mind for them to show up in. And we can experience the thoughts. We can experience feelings, we can experience moods, all these different elements that we would assign to the mental realm. And so then as a way of making sense out of that, we say, well, all those things happen in the mind. There are other ways of talking about it, but that's one way that we do talk about it. So when we say, there is a mind, And the chapter does talk at various times in that way. You say, well, the mind is like this, the mind is like that. But it's all kind of a theory, right? We don't really have any direct experience of a thing called the mind. It just makes the most sense, you might say, to in a kind of common sense way, to say, well, there are all these mental things. What makes them mental is that they all happen in the mind. It's like saying there are all these physical things. What makes them physical, or the reason we know they're physical, is they show up in physical space. But we don't actually encounter it. And the mind doesn't actually do anything. There are just events that happen in the mind. So, partly this is a question of how we talk about things, but we want to kind of get clear that the mental side is the immediacy of it has nothing to do with a thing called mind. So Hayward has a question here. Does the tree space exist separate from the mind space that knows it? Okay, well, that's a good question and a nice way of framing the issue. So here's what I'd say. Maybe this isn't the best way to say it. or maybe it's wrong, but here's what I'd say, is that the mind space, there's a knowing, and we say the knowing takes place in the mind. And again, we don't really know that. There's no evidence for that, you could say. But we refer the knowing to the mental realm. We say, so in our minds, we know that there's a tree out there. Right? And the knowing takes place in space. Now, what do we know? We know the tree, that we see the tree, let's say. So that's a form of knowing. And part of seeing the tree is seeing that it's there in physical space. So in a very immediate sense, we actually, in order to see the tree, we really have to see, in some sense, we have to see the space around the tree and actually also the space that the tree occupies. So we know that space. Does that space exist separate from the mind space that knows it? Well, no, because the only place it shows up is in the mind space, is in the act of knowing. Now, part of what we know about the space that the tree occupies is that it continues to exist even if we turn our backs, right? We no longer know it. Or we go away and we forget that we ever saw a tree. But if you asked us, you know, is the tree space still there, even though it's not entering into our mind space? Yeah, absolutely, it is. But how do we know that? Well, that's just what we understand tree spaces to be like. It's not because we have direct experience of it. We can't. You know, it's the example we must have used in here sometimes is there are certain kinds of questions you can't really answer that have to do with your experience. And the image to think of is, does the light in the refrigerator stay on when you close the refrigerator door? Well, you can't tell, because the only way you can find out is to open the refrigerator door to see, and then it's gone. You know, then you're no longer looking at the closed refrigerator. It's kind of that way with experience generally. Here's a couple of other comments. Good. Michael says, my knowing seems to feel the need for confirmation from a realm that I believe to be larger, greater, and more reliable than my own thoughts. I assume you mean here, Michael, the physical realms. Like, you know, the fact that we see a tree. Let's take the opposite of an ordinary physical space. In some sense, is dream space, right? So in a dream, we see a tree, and then we wake up and we say, well, that tree was just it. You know, it wasn't. It was part of my mental space. It wasn't larger than my mental space, greater, I'm just quoting you, it wasn't greater than my mental space, it wasn't more reliable. It was just a thought, it was just a dream I had, and now it's gone, and it's not reliable, you know? It's not, I can't build my life on that kind of experience, because now the tree is here, and now it's gone. So when you say my knowing feels the need for confirmation, yes, a very good explanation or theory for making sense of the world that we live in is that it exists independent of our knowledge of it, and it's more reliable, right? It's larger and greater. I think you mean, I'm using your sense here of this. It's larger, greater, it's more reliable. It doesn't just depend on my own thoughts. Yeah, there is that kind of experience. And I'm not in any way trying to suggest that there isn't. I'm just saying that the only access we have is through our own mind, through our own knowing. And that's kind of the fundamental place to look. But part of what we know is that it's a mind-independent reality. So do we experience its independence? Well, you could say in some senses we do. You know, we can build instruments that measure, you know, a video camera, let's say. So the video camera keeps rolling. You know, we see this tree, we put the camera in front of it, we leave and keep the video camera on, and the day later we come back and we have 24 hours footage of the tree, and it's still there the whole time. So we have evidence. But in the end, it's always going to refer back to our experience and making sense of our experience. Now, I'm not and this is discussed in the TSK book in various places, I'm not suggesting that this physical space reality is somehow only mind perception. No, the very nature of what shows up in physical space is that it's more, it's independent of the mind. And that's just the way things that show up in physical space are. That's an attribute of the physical space. But so maybe one way of saying this, and you know, we could kind of tie ourselves in knots with this for a long time. I don't want to do that. But let me try one more way of talking about it. And that is to say that the physical space let's say it this way. If you think in terms of great space or something that is more than our ordinary space, and you say that great space, we'll use that word for now, we say great space has this open, allowing quality. That's what space is. That's fundamental to space. And then that space shows up in various realms, and this has to do with focal settings. Depending on the focal setting that you're working with, you experience certain things. You know, there's a mental realm focal setting, and there's a physical realm focal setting. And in the physical realm focal setting, part of what's given in that physical realm is physical space. That's not great space. That's not this more fundamental, open, allowing. But one of the ways in which that openness shows up, given the particular focal setting, is as objects and the physical space that contains them. That physical space shares in the qualities of space, but it's already limited. And that's, you know, we'll look at that, and actually we'll turn to that in a moment. Because Rinpoche says at the very beginning of the reading we had this time that he says ordinary space deceives us. And we want to look, you know, why does he say that? What's going on? We want to look at that in a moment. Now, Sudhi says, we can't know the answer to that. And I think that here is referring to, this idea that there's something that extends or is more, is independent of our minds. Because, based on our given faculty, we can say that we experience only the mind space. That's right. And so we've been talking about that. I just don't want that to be turned into a kind of sense that physical space isn't real and that the tree doesn't exist when we're not looking at it. No, it does. That's the nature of trees. It's the nature of physical space. Given the focal setting, that's how things function. So let's look at that in terms of a physical space and what Rinpoche says about physical space deceiving us. So what does that mean, given what we've been saying right now? So he says this on page 55. Let's take a look at it. He says, he says, our ordinary knowing capacity, he starts off by talking about how space feels closed down, right? It's cramped. And it leads us to see the world in certain ways. And it makes things seem more complex and so on. And then he says, the effect of this is that our ordinary knowing capacity is deceived by the apparent interaction of events and reactions. Those interactions make it look like there's a continuous stream, and then we wind up looking for cause and effect and coming and going. And he says that's just built into the physical world. That's how we just, we don't have any other way of thinking about that. And mostly that's how we understand the mental world also. So, what is the deception? Let me just try to say something about that. Lower space gives us things in space. And that's the deception, basically. The it's not so much that space sets out to deceive us, you know. Space is not this evil force that that wants us to see things in the wrong way and that, you know, deceives us. It's that as long as we're connected to lower space, as long as we understand the world in lower space terms, we can't penetrate the surface of experience. And the surface of experience is all these things popping up. And here he's making space, he's bringing space and mind together. So in the physical realm, lower space in the physical realm, leads us to talk in terms of causes and conditions and so on, and stable identities too, although I don't think he says that here. Lower space in the mental realm, again, leads us to talk in terms of causes and conditions and continuity in a way that just is inaccurate. And he's going to go about, he's going to go on to describe the way in which it's inaccurate, mostly in terms of mental space. So if we wanted not to be deceived, we'd have to be able to find a way to contact the open, accommodating quality of higher level space or great space, rather than this lower level, which is always going to throw us into the realm of this and that and first and next and cause and effect. Those are the structures. That's what we take as reality. And that is a kind of fundamental deception. Now, I think I'll just leave it at that. So when he applies that in the realm of the mind, so we were looking at page 55. If we go ahead and look at page 56, and now he's talking about how we can begin to apply a greater awareness, which is based on seeing a higher space. Right? He says, this is going to help deal with this deception or this confusion. And he says in the first full paragraph on 56, once we develop more awareness, we can begin to see that events and thoughts, which we have seen as a continuous surface stream, do not actually have the dynamic connections that we commonly assume and attribute to them. So this is important. And I'm not sure that the significance of that comes across as clearly as I'd like. So let me take a minute or two to talk about it. Back around the beginning of the 20th century, if we look at William James in the realm of psychology, and we look at James Joyce and others in the realm of literature, people discovered this notion of what came to be called the stream of consciousness. Right? There's the mind just floats along or flows along, and there's all these different things that arise in the mind. And the very fact that people discovered that is interesting and important, and I haven't studied that, but it seems that in some sense they began to pay more attention to the inner world than people had before that. And one of the first things they discovered is that things are always changing in terms of our inner experience. And of course, anybody who's done any meditation knows that. And so there came to be this talk about the stream of consciousness. And Rinpoche here too is talking about a continuous surface stream. But he's also saying that's not a very good description of what's actually going on. There's a certain assumption we make, and that is that the stream kind of goes from one moment to the next, and there are connections, linear connections, among those moments. And that's not true. And this is something that is so easy to verify in our experience, but people make the assumption. Again, you know, if you do meditation, you know this, but this is a good thing for you to look at. I'm not exactly assigning this as the variation, but it's certainly good to look at. And if you have a meditation practice, you've already had a lot of experience, but maybe you haven't thought about it in quite this way. The point that I want to make here is if you look at a description of stream of consciousness in Joyce, for instance, there's the very famous passage at the end of Ulysses, goes on for 60 pages, I think, and it's Molly Bloom's stream of consciousness. That stream of consciousness goes from, it's connected. Every event is connected to the next event. Now, I'm probably overstating that, but mostly one event brings up the next. It's the notion that we think of, it became, Freud made it very popular in psychoanalysis, with the idea of free association, right? One thing leads you to the next. But if you actually look at your experience, there isn't necessarily a connection between one moment and the next. You know, one moment you're looking at something, and the next moment you're remembering something, and the next moment you're thinking of something, and the next moment you're remembering something else. There isn't any connection. Sometimes you can trace out connections, but a lot of times, moments just pop up. They're unconnected to, you know, what we think of as the moment before and the moment after. And actually, the exercise, you know, about space between thoughts is in part a way into that, because if there's a space, then what comes up in the moment after the space may have nothing at all to do with what comes up in the moment before the space. And that space then is a way of investigating the openness and the allowing quality, which is one reason why you would do that exercise. Right? So we think of thoughts as connected to each other, or mental events as connected to each other, in the same way that we think of things as stable and solid. Things are not really stable and solid in the way that we usually imagine. The giant body exercises at the beginning of TSK are partly a way of getting into that. But it's actually harder to see that in terms of things, because we're so committed to the idea that a thing mostly stays the same unless it gets acted upon by some force. You know, the table is the table is the table is the table. You can challenge that, but it feels a little bit artificial or abstract to do so. But in the mind, it's so easy to see that what goes on in one moment doesn't have necessarily anything at all to do with what goes on in the next moment. We're always bouncing around from one thing to the next. Rinpoche uses the image sometimes of bubbles popping up. So Michael has a question here. Is the stream of consciousness like the idea of a continuous physical reality, both seeming to give us a stable reality to protect us from emptiness? Well, yes, that's what I just said. Although, you know, you give an explanation at the end, it protects us from emptiness. That may be right. I'm not going to go there right now. It may be right, or, you know, it may be incomplete. You know, do we do this because we need to protect ourselves from something? Well, maybe. But it does seem to be the way the mind works. So, yes, continuous stream, that's the mind's version of stable and solid. Right? So one reason it's easier to see that, I think, is that thoughts and memories and so on that show up in the mind are mind. You know, they're mental stuff. You know, so in the beginning of the TSK book, there's this sentence on page 10 that people have trouble with. It says, that we talked about a little, it says space is projecting space into space, and that's all there is. In things that look like objects, that's just space projecting space. And people say, well, but wait a minute, you know, objects are not space, they're more solid and substantial and so on. And that's difficult to kind of work with. But with the mind, it's much easier. If you said mind is projecting mind into mind, that actually just makes perfectly good everyday sense. You know, you say mind manifests in various ways. Sometimes, this is assuming there is a mind, but sometimes as thoughts, sometimes as feelings, and so on. So it's always just mind, 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 mind. You know, mind is projecting mind into mind. You could say that. So working with the mind gives us a very handy way to look at this, and it helps us to challenge what Rinpoche talks about as the fundamental deception of lower level space. So how do we get out of that? You know, we're always on this surface of a continuous stream, and we accept that as being real. What can we do about that? The basic move that you want to be able to make is to develop a different kind of knowing, right? And that's what Rinpoche is talking about here. He says, you know, we were just looking at this paragraph, the first paragraph on 56, and he says, we think there's this continuous surface stream, but actually there are not those dynamic connections. And once we realize that, we can relax and open up. We don't have to always make everything fit together because it doesn't fit together. It's kind of the only way we can make it fit together is by ignoring most of what's happening. And then we look back and say, oh yeah, this was connected with this. We've ignored all the things that are not connected. It's a little bit like, you know, a Rorschach test. Most of you have probably come across that in psychology. They take an ink blot. It's always a symmetrical ink blot, but it's just a messy blob of ink. And they ask people to interpret it. And if you've ever looked at one of those, I'm sure you can see examples online. In order to make a story out of that ink blot, which is what they want to do in the Rorschach test, you have to ignore 80% of what's going on. You know, and then you seize on certain characteristics and you say, well, this is what's going on. And then you tell a story about it. Well, that's a good analogy for how the mind works in general. We seize on things and we say, well, yes, there was continuity. There was connection. This came and then that came. There's linear sequences, but it's way messier than that. Thoughts are much more incoherent. And once we are ready to accept that by relaxing our wish to make sense out of everything, then we touch a deeper knowing. And that's what Rinpoche is talking about here in this discussion on page 56. Part of what that means is that we stop insisting that the self is the one that knows. And we've talked about that before. This is the knowing that he's talking about putting in place is not a knowing that belongs to the self. Right? And he says that in the next paragraph. I'm not going to discuss it right now. And as you let go of that wish to make everything fall into place and make sense, it's like entering a higher space. There's more insight and there's more space. And those two things go together. And that, of course, is really important to understand, that connection between the two. And what you see, and part of what makes this possible, and part of what you realize through it as well, is what he says on page 57 at the bottom, a few lines from the bottom. He says, by challenging the motion and directedness of thought, so that linear stream we were talking about, we're opening to the emergence of a knowing which discerns that thoughts are going nowhere, getting nowhere, pointing nothing out. And that's that kind of bubble image, right? And it's very much related to exercise 11, which asks you to look for the source of thoughts. It asks you where thoughts come from, where thoughts go. Well, you need to investigate that. I mean, that was the assignment for last week, but you need to investigate that. But there is a kind of an answer that is built into what TSK is saying. If you look for the source of thoughts, you don't really find one. Because if there were a source, there would be this linear flow. You know, the thought came from here, and now I'm aware of it, and now it's going somewhere else. And thoughts aren't like that, as he says here. They're going nowhere, they're getting nowhere, they're pointing nothing out. That doesn't mean that it's not helpful to look for a source. That can be very helpful. But, you know, a better description would be something like a steady string of spaces that show up, and each one is separate, each one is independent. And even the notion that they show up one after another is already saying too much. That's when we try to explain, maybe, what's going on. Okay, so the way to develop this more insightful approach is through, certainly it's from the reading, I hope, and I hope our discussion helps, you know, give you at least a little sense of how that could be. But also through doing the exercises and then doing what I'm now calling variations, where we see things in unaccustomed ways, so we investigate things. in unaccustomed ways. So we've already talked about exercise 11, which basically is meant to help you see that the thoughts don't have this solid identity, which would lead them, you know, they kind of pass on their content to the next thought and to the next thought. It's not like that. You know? And exercise 12 is similar, and Rinpoche makes very clear that exercises 11, 12, and 13 are connected to each other. Exercise 12 is about looking for the space between thoughts, and you know what you have to, you can do that exercise, although I think it's not so easy to do. We'll talk about that in a moment. But when you look for the space between, it's not really a space that you're looking for. You know, it's not a lower level space. One of these different, there's mind space, there's physical space, and then there's a space between. Well, that space between is not at the same level as mind space and physical space. In order to discover it, you need to be able to let go of the space that gets all filled up either with mental events or physical events or the absence of those events. You have to let go of all of that. And that's that takes some practice. Another way of saying that is that when you're doing exercise 12, when you're looking for the space between thoughts, it won't work if you're the one doing it. You know, you won't be able to get to the level of insight that's being suggested. Now, I want to say something here that may not be quite right, but it struck me when I was preparing for class, and I hope it's at least not too misleading, and that is that exercise 12 is a very meditative practice. That is to say, if you really want to look for the space between thoughts, a good way to do that would be to go on retreat. And if you don't go on retreat, a good way to do it would be to spend at least a couple of hours a day doing this practice. That might help. And so what I want to say that, you know, I'm not completely sure about, but it seems right, is that this first TSK book is a little different from the other later TSK books in that it sometimes points us in this meditative direction. That is, it says, do this practice which really requires you to deeply enter into your experience. And you can find many instances of this in the first TSK book. You know, he says, do this practice 4 hours a day for 2 weeks, or do 4 2-week retreats a year, or do this practice for 45 minutes 4 times a day. Or, you know, he really is asking for a strong commitment. And I think exercise 12 is an example of a practice that has this meditation component to it. And I think that in the later books, there's a little bit of a turn away from that, which is one reason why when we do TSK retreats, we very often pull the exercises, not always, but very often pull the exercises from the first book, because in a retreat setting, these are great exercises to go into in depth, and you can really understand and discover a lot by doing that. But in the later books, I think they're, what's being pointed towards in those books is the possibility of doing an inquiry that doesn't depend on settling into a kind of a meditative calm where you can let go of ordinary structures. Instead, you do the inquiry within your ordinary structures. And exercise 13, which is seeing thoughts as space, is an example of that. I mean, I'm not saying it's only in the later books, but in the first book, this book that we're working with now, I think Rinpoche does both. So some of what he's presenting is more appropriate for a kind of a retreat-centered, really intensive engagement with the material where you set aside the rest of your life, you know, and do TSK. And I think in the later books, it's a little bit more saying, well, within your ordinary life, how can you do TSK? The first book does both. Exercise 13 does both. Does this more within your life kind of exercise. So when Rinpoche says, and this is what got me thinking about this really, When he's discussing exercise 13, he says exercise 12 is necessary. He said it's provisional. It's on page 60. He says exercise 12 is necessary as a provisional approach, but then you go on and do exercise 13. And I would say maybe it's not necessary. It's you know, if you're going to do it in a meditative way, you can do it. And I encourage you to do it. Great, wonderful practice. But you might just be able to go to exercise 13. Exercise 11 will help a lot. But exercise 13, just seeing thoughts as space. And in fact, again and again and again, you know, this is more like the quality of doing variations. You can do that within your ordinary experience. And remember this notion of variations. It comes about or is introduced or discussed or identified at the bottom of page 64. That page has a lot going on, and I suggest you look at it again very carefully. But at the very bottom of the page, and we've already talked about this, he says, the exercises, he's talking about exercises 11 through 13. He says, these exercises help us work with outputs of the mind setting in ways that are uncharacteristic for that setting. So you've got a focal setting, you're going to work with it, but you're going to work with it in ways that kind of challenge it because they don't fit, they're uncharacteristic, they're variations. That's where I'm taking the word variation from. So I hope that's accurate, as I said. I started thinking about it. I've always had the sense that there is something different about the first TSK book, and you know, as we've talked about this, and everybody who's worked with TSK knows this, that there are people who love the first TSK book and are not so interested in the later books, and there are people who can't get into the first book and they find the later books more accessible. I think there is a distinction, and I've just been trying to point to the distinction. Okay, so this is the point where I would have introduced a nice variation practice, but we don't have time. We're out of time. I'm not surprised because as I was preparing for this class, I just started thinking there's so much material to cover. Cover is a funny word, isn't it? It's like, you know, you don't have to cover the material. It's not like, oh, now you have all the things you need to know for the test. There's so much important material here, so many important ways of engaging. As you know, my sense is that reading the books is itself a kind of an exercise. And when I do these classes, I'm really trying to help you engage the written material and maybe to some extent the practice material in ways that help you discover, you know, help you see how much is going on and what there is that's important. So there is a variation that I am going to suggest we work with, and I'll just put it in the orientation. So I've been using the orientations in a kind of illegitimate way, maybe, but since I made it up, it's not illegitimate. I'm just going to redefine it. I'm using the orientations not only as a way of leading us into the next session or next class, which in this case is going to be about time. But I'm also using them to be able to, to be kind of practical about it, to bring in things that we didn't have time for in this phone call. So I'll be doing that in the orientation, and I will give you a variation that I hope you can apply during the coming week. You know, it's so important. During the week, these variations, I think, really help in addition to the sitting practice. And even if you only do it, you know, if every day you spend 5 minutes, and I'm not saying you have to put this on your calendar or something you have to do every day, but hopefully, you know, you're engaging the material, it's interesting material, you want to understand it, and I think the way to do that is if you just take 5 minutes a day to look at these variations and just wonder and just ask questions. That will open up things so much. That'll be so valuable and important. So I will go into that a little more in the orientation. Next week we will start at our second go-round with time. Okay. Thank you, everybody.